Chapter 3. "Bondon," said Jack Aubrey to his coxswain, "tell the doctor that if he's at leisure, there's something to be seen on deck." The doctor was at leisure. The cello on which he'd been practising gave a last deep boom, and he ran up the companion ladder, an expectant look on his face. "There, right on the beam," said Jack, nodding southwards. "You can catch the breakers at its foot as clear as can be on the rise." "Certainly," said Stephen, watching Malin Head fade and faintly reappear in the thin rain. Then, feeling that something more was expected of him, "I am obliged to you for showing it to me. It'll be your last glimpse of your native land for about 16 degrees of latitude and God knows how many of longitude, for I mean to make a great offing if ever I can. Should you like to look at it with a telescope?"
"If you please," said Stephen.
He was fond of his native land, even though this piece of it looked unnaturally black, wet, and uninviting. But he couldn't wish the spectacle prolonged, particularly as he knew from personal experience that part of this province was inhabited by a tackling, guileful, tale-bearing, noisy, contemptible, mean, wretched, unsteady, and inhospitable people. And as soon as he decently could, he clapped the glass to, handed it back, and returned to his cello. They were to attempt another Mozart quartet in a few days, and he didn't wish to disgrace himself in the presence of the purser's far more accomplished playing. Left alone, Jack continued his habitual pacing fore and aft. He must have covered hundreds and hundreds of miles on this same quarter-deck in the course of all these years, and the ring-bolt near the taffrail where he turned shone like silver. It was also dangerously thin. He was glad to have seen Malin Head so clear. It proved that in Ystrahol and the Garvans, upon which many a better navigator than himself had come to grief, especially in thick weather with no sight of the sun by day or any star by night, were all safely astern. After a measured mile for good luck, he gave the orders that would carry the ship as nearly due west as the southwest wind would allow, and he found to his pleasure that she needed it only half a point free to run happily at 7 knots under no more than topsails and courses, though a moderate sea kept striking her larboard bow with all the regularity of a long-established swell, throwing her slightly off her course and sweeping spray and even packets of water diagonally across the forecastle and the waist. This, and the taste of salt on his lips, was a deep satisfaction. Yet at the same time he knew that the frigate's people were, upon the whole, low-spirited, disappointed, and out of humour. He thought it very probable that some of the more dismal hands might already be using the words "an unlucky voyage" or "a Jonah aboard," which could become very dangerous indeed if they got a firm hold on the ship's collective mind, always inclined to fatalism. Even more dangerous in a ship with no marines, no articles of war, no recourse to the service as a whole, a ship in which the captain's authority depended solely on his standing, and his standing on his present as well as his past success. This he hadn't learnt from listening to their conversation, nor from reports brought by confidential hands like Bondon or Killick, or the equivalent of the master-at-arms or the ship's corporal. He hated a tale-bearer, but from having spent most of his life afloat, some of it as a foremast jack. His gauging of the ship's mood was, for the most part, unconscious. Faintly recorded impressions of dutifulness rather than zeal. Lack of coarse, humorous remarks forward. The occasional wry look or contentious answer between shipmates and the general want of tone. But though it was largely instinctive, it was surprisingly accurate. "There's little hope of any consolation in these waters unless we chance on an American," he reflected. "But at least for the rest of the month we shall have regular blue water sailing, tack upon tack every watch until we reach the westerlies. Plenty to keep them busy, but not too much. And then presently we shall see the sun again. Far out into the Atlantic. Long tack upon long tack. Every day having the same steady routine, from swabbing the decks at first dawn to lights out. Its unchanging succession of bells. Its wholly predictable food. Nothing in sight from one horizon to another but sea and sky, both growing more agreeable. And the habit of sea life exerted its usual force. Cheerfulness returned to almost its old carefree level, and as always there was the violent emotion and enthusiasm of the great gun practice every evening at quarters. Practice carried out with the full deadly charge and the ball directed at a floating target. While the Surprise was making her westing, Jack spent more in barrels of powder than ever he would have made in prize money if the snow had been taken. He justified this to his conscience, for no one else, least of all Stephen, questioned the expense, by an appeal to the frigate's very high standards of rapid, accurate fire, by the fact that all hands were somewhat rusty, and the Orkneymen, some of whom had come aboard with crossbows, had very little notion of combined, disciplined practice at all. But he knew very well that the thunderous roar, the stabbing flame in the smoke cloud, the screech of the recoiling gun, the competition between watch and watch, and the ecstasy when a raft of beef cask 200 yards away flew suddenly to pieces in a flurry of white water and single staves flung high, did a great deal towards restoring the general tone and bringing the Surprise back towards the state of a happy ship, the only efficient fighting machine, the only ship that it was a pleasure to command. Only in a few exceptional cases did this state arise spontaneously, as when a good set of foremast hands happened to enter upon a dry, weatherly ship with efficient warrant officers. The boatswain was often a most important figure where happiness was concerned. A decent group of seaman-like officers, and a taut but not tyrannical captain. Otherwise it had to be nursed along. The lower deck had its own way of dealing with really worthless hands, turning them out of their messes and leading them a horrible life. But there were others, stronger characters, men of some education, who could cause serious trouble if they chanced to be both awkward and discontented. In the Surprise, at present, for example, there were 8 Shelmerstonians serving before the mast who had had commands of their own, while there were more who had been mates and who understood navigation. The same applied, in rather a different way, to the wardroom or gunroom, as the case might be. An ill-fitting member of that small society could upset the working of the whole ship to a remarkable degree. And the small failings that wouldn't matter at all during a passage to Gibraltar might assume gigantic proportions in the course of a long commission. A couple of years blockading Toulon, for example, or 3 on the African station. And Jack was wondering whether he'd been very wise in appointing Standish purser, almost entirely on the basis of the man's excellent violin playing and the recommendation of Martin, who had been acquainted with him at Oxford, and in spite of Standish's want of experience. Except for that excellence, Jack had rarely been more mistaken in a man. The modesty and diffidence that the penniless, unemployed Standish had brought aboard were now no longer to be seen. And the assurance of a monthly income and a settled position had developed a displeasing and often didactic loquacity. He was also, of course, incompetent. As Jack said in his letter to Sophie, I had supposed anyone with common sense could become a tolerable purser, but I was wrong. He did make an attempt at first, but as he's seasick every time we hand to gallants, and as he can neither add nor multiply so as to get the same answer twice, he soon grew discouraged, and now he leaves everything to his steward and Jack in the dust. He's not without his good points. He's perfectly honest, which cannot be said of all purses. And it was most gentlemanly in him not to let anyone know that he was a strong swimmer after I'd pulled him out of the sea. And he listens attentively, even eagerly, when Stephen and Martin explain the ship's manoeuvres to him, and the difference between the planshear and the spurketing. But apart from these lectures, and it'd do your heart good to hear them, when he's quiet, he talks, he talks, he talks, and always about himself. Tom, West, and Davidge, who have had no more education than can be picked up aboard ship, and who aren't much given to reading, are rather shy of him, a university man, and Martin's wonderfully charitable. But this cannot last, because, as well as being incompetent as a purser, he's also sadly foolish. Jack paused, remembering an incident during his most recent dinner with the gunroom, when he heard someone in the midst of Standish's long anecdote say, "I didn't know you'd been a schoolmaster." "Oh, it was only for a short time when my fortunes were low. That's a recourse we university men always have in case of temporary embarrassment. You can always take refuge in a school if you have a degree. Delightful task to teach the young idea how to shoot," observed Stephen. "Oh, no," cried Standish. "My duties were of a far higher order. I took them through Lily and the Gradus. Another man came in and taught them fencing and archery and pistol practice and that kind of thing." Jack returned to his pen. "But it is the music that particularly distresses me. Martin is not a gifted player, and Standish perpetually puts him right. Shows him how his fingering is at fault, and his bowing, and the way he holds his instrument, and his notion of the tempo, and his phrasing. He's already offered Stephen a few hints, and I think that when he grows bolder he may do the same kind office by me. I was very much mistaken in supposing I could play second fiddle to such a man, and I shall have to find some decent excuse. The music is, indeed, celestial. How such a man can so lose himself in it and play so well is beyond my comprehension. But I do not look forward to this evening's bout at all. Perhaps there'll be none. The sea's getting up a little." Jack paused, reread the last page, and shook his head. Sophie disliked fault-finding. It distressed her. And she'd heard a very great deal of it when she was a girl. And fault-finding in a letter might well sound harsher than by word of mouth. He balled up the sheet and threw it into the waste-paper basket. A mine of interest to Killick and those members of the crew who shared his confidence. And as he did so, he heard Pullings cry, "Stand by to hand, fore-to-gallant!" followed immediately by the boatswain's call. There was no music that evening, apart from some quiet rumbling over familiar paths by Aubrey and Maturin, an evenly shared mediocrity, and an hour or so of their favourite exercise, which was improvisation on a theme proposed by one and answered by the other, which sometimes rose well above mediocrity because of their deep mutual comprehension, in this field at least. Standish sent his excuses, regretted that indisposition prevented him from having the honour, etc. And Martin, in his double capacity of assistant surgeon and early acquaintance, sat by the wretched purser's side holding a bowl. There was no music when they reached the Westerlies either, for they were blowing briskly with a little north in them, so briskly that the Surprise went bowling along under close-reefed topsails with the wind on her quarter at 9 and even 10 knots, wallowing at the bottom of her long roll and pitch in a way that did her little credit. This splendid breeze held day after day, only slackening when they were approaching the Burlings. Martin led Standish on deck to view them that evening. Cruel, jagged rocks, far out in a troubled ocean and under a troubled sky, the horizon dark. The purser clung to the rail, looking hungrily at these first specks of land since Malin Head. His clothes hung loose about him.
"I hope I see you in better trim, Mr. Standish," said Jack Aubrey. "Even at this gentle rate, we should raise the Rock of Lisbon by dawn, and if we're lucky with our tide, you may eat your dinner in Black Horse Square. Nothing sets a man up like a good square meal."
"But before that," said Stephen, "Mr. Standish would be well advised to eat a couple of eggs, lightly boiled and taken with a little softened biscuit, as soon as ever his stomach will bear them. Then he may have a good restorative, roborative sleep. As for the eggs, I heard two of the gunroom hens proclaim that they had laid this morning."
They did indeed raise the Rock of Lisbon a little before the dawn of a brilliantly sparkling clear morning, with warm, scented air breathing off the land. And at the same time they passed HMS Briseis, 74, a cloud of sail in the offing, obviously homeward bound from Lisbon, and making the most of the stronger breeze out there. Jack struck his topsails, as in duty bound to a king's ship, and Briseis, now commanded by an amiable man called Lampson, returned the salute, at the same time throwing out a signal whose only intelligible word was happy. But they were not lucky with their tide. Breathing the warm, scented air was certainly a delight to those that longed for land, but it prevented the Surprise from crossing the Tagus Bar, and she was obliged to anchor all through slack water and well beyond before the pilot would consent to take her in. In this lake-like peace, Standish, who had eaten his two eggs the evening before and had spent a calm night, spent his time eating first 3 pints of portable soup thickened with oatmeal, and then a large quantity of ham. This recovered his spirits wonderfully, and although he was still feeble, he gasped his way into the main top, where Stephen and Martin were to explain the operation of getting under way. Below them on the quarter-deck, the pilot finished his account of how the Weymouth, relying on her own knowledge of the river, had been wrecked on the bar, just over there, 3 points on the starboard bow, not quite a mile away, with the words, "And all for the sake of the pilot's fee." "That was very bad, I'm sure," said Jack. "Were the people saved?"
"A few," said the pilot reluctantly, "but those few were all horribly disfigured.
Now, sir, whenever you please to give the word, I believe we may proceed." "All hands on moor ship," said Jack, raising his voice to the pitch of an order, though every man had been at his station these 10 minutes past, angrily willing the pilot to stop his prating, to stash it, to pipe down. And instantly the boatswain sprung his call.
"See," cried Stephen, "the carpenter and his crew put the bars in the capstan. They ship them, pin them, and swift them. They bring the messenger to the capstan. The gunner ties its rounded ends together. What are they called, Maturin?"
"Let us not be too pedantic, for our love. The whole point is, the messenger is now endless. It is a serpent that has swallowed its own tail."
"I cannot see it," said Standish, leaning far out over the rail. "Where is this messenger?"
"Why," said Martin, "it's that rope they're putting over the rollers just beneath us in the waist. A vast loop that goes from the capstan to two other stout vertical rollers by the hawse holes, and so back."
"I don't understand. I see the capstan, but there's no rope round it at all."
"What you see is the upper capstan," said Stephen with some complacency. "The messenger is twined about the lower part under the quarter-deck. But both the lower and the upper part are equipped with bars. Both turn, both heave, as we say. See, they undo the deck stoppers, or dog stoppers, as some superficial observers call them. They loosen the starboard cable, the cable on the right-hand side. They throw off the turnabout, the riding bits. What force and dexterity! They bring the messenger to the cable. They bind it to the cable with nippers.
Where? I can't see."
"Well, of course not. They're right forward by the hawse holes, where the cable comes into the ship under the forecastle."
"But presently,"
said Stephen in a comforting tone, "you will perceive the cable come creeping aft, led by the messenger." John Foley, the Shelmiston fiddler, skipped onto the capstan head. At his first notes, the men at the bars stepped out, and after the first turns, they brought on the strain. Three deep voices and one clear tenor sang, "Yo, heave ho! Round the capstan go! Heave, men, with a will, tramp and tramp it still, the anchor must be weighed, the anchor must be weighed!" Joined by all in a roaring, "Yo, heave ho! Yo, heave ho!" Five times repeated, before the three struck in again, "Yo, heave ho! Raise her from below. Heave, men, with a will, tramp and tramp it still, the anchor's off the ground, the anchor's off the ground!" "There's your cable," said Martin in a very much louder voice after the first few lines. "So it is," said Standish, and having stared at it coming in like a great wet serpent, he went on, "but it's not going to the capstan at all."
"Certainly not," said Stephen in a screech above the full chorus. "It's far too thick to bend round the capstan. Furthermore, it's loaded with the vile mud of Tagus." They undo the nippers and let the cable down the main hatchway and so to the orlop where they coil it on the cable tiers, said Martin, and they hurry back with the nippers to bind fresh cable to the messenger as it travels round.
"How active they are," observed Stephen. "See how diligently they answer Captain Pulling's request to light along the messenger, that is to say, pull along the slack on that side which is not heaving in. And how they run with the nippers. Davies has knocked place flat." "What are those men doing with the other cable?" asked Standish.
"They're veering it out," answered Martin quickly.
"You are to understand that we are moored," said Stephen. "In other words, we are held by two anchors, widely separated. When we approach the one, therefore, by pulling on its cable, the cable belonging to the other must necessarily be let out. And this is done by the veering cablemen. But their task is almost over, for, if I don't mistake, we are short stay apeak. I say we are short stay apeak." But before he could insist upon this term, better than any Martin could produce, and reasonably accurate, a voice from the forecastle called, "Heave and away, sir!" Whereupon Jack cried, "Heave and rally!" with great force. All the veerers ran to the bars, the fiddler fiddled extremely fast, and with a violent grunting, "Yo, heave ho!" they broke the anchor from its bed and ran it up to the bows. The subsequent operations, the hooking of the cat to the anchor ring, the running of the anchor up to the cat head, the fishing of the anchor, the shifting of the messenger for the other cable, which, of course, required a contrary turn, and many more, were too rapid and perhaps too obscure to be explained before Jack gave the order, "Up, anchor!" And the music started again. But this time they sang, "We'll heave him up from down below, way O'Kriana. That is where the cocks do crow, we're all bound over the mountain." To the sound of a shrill, sweet fife. The ship moved easily, steadily over the water. The tide was making fast. And presently west, on the forecastle, called, "Up and down, sir." "He means that we are directly over the anchor," said Stephen. "Now you'll see something."
"Loose topsails," said Jack in little more than a conversational voice, and at once the shrouds were dark with men racing aloft. He gave no more orders. The surprises lay out, let fall, sheeted home, hoisted and braced the topsails with perfect unity, as though they'd all served together throughout a long commission. The frigate gathered way, plucked the anchor from its bed, and moved smoothly up the Tagus.
"If you can bring her to one of the moorings in the middle reach in time for me to have dinner in Black Horse Square, you shall have an extra 5 guineas," said Jack as he handed the ship over to the pilot. By 3 o'clock, said the pilot, looking at the sky and then over the side.
I believe it may be done.
Even earlier, if possible, said Jack. He was an old-fashioned creature in some ways, as his hero Nelson had been. He still wore his hair long and plaited into a clubbed pigtail, not cut in the short, modern Brutus manner. He put on his cocked hat athwartships rather than fore and aft, and he liked his dinner at the traditional captain's 2 o'clock. But tradition was now failing him. Naval habits were beginning to ape those of the land, where dinner at 5, 6, and even 7 was becoming frequent. And at sea, most post-captains, particularly if they had guests, dined at 3. Jack's stomach was even more conservative than his mind, but at present he'd trained it to hold out with tolerable good humour until 2:30. The hands had their dinner, 2 pounds of salt beef, 1 pound of ship's bread and a pint of grog, as soon as the ship was over the worst of the bar. The members of the gun room had theirs at 1. It smelt to Jack like uncommonly good roast mutton. And when Belem was clear on the larboard bow, they came on deck, rosy and comfortable, to view the tower and Lisbon itself, white in the distance beyond. Jack went below to see whether a biscuit and a glass of Madeira would quieten the wolf within, and there he found Stephen with an almanac and a small paper of calculations. "I dare say you're working out when we shall pick up the trades," he said. "Will you join me in a glass of Madeira and a biscuit? We had a very early breakfast." "With all my heart. But the trade winds I leave to you entirely. What I'm looking for is the saint's day upon which my daughter will most probably be born. These things cannot be foretold to the day, nor even to the week, so I shall have to spread my offerings pretty wide. But on the most likely, most physically orthodox day, what clouds of incense will go up, what mounds of pure beeswax. And in looking through this almanac, I see that it was on St. Eudoxia's day, when the Ethiopian Copts so strangely celebrate Pontius Pilate, that Pardeen would have been hanged but for your great kindness. I shall have a mass said for his intention as soon as we get ashore. It was no great kindness, I do assure you. When I went, they looked very grave because they thought I wanted a sinecure or a place at court for a friend. But when I said it was only a man's life, they cheered up amazingly, laughed, told me the weather had been delightful these last days and gave me the paper out of hand. But tell me, why are you so sure that Diana is going to be brought to bed of a girl? Can you imagine her being brought to bed of anything else? Jack could perfectly well imagine it. But he had so often heard Stephen speak of his future delight in the company of this little hypothetical daughter that he only said, "The pilot tells me there are no other men of war in the river, which is just as well, though with a certain amount of awkwardness. He also tells me that the post office is shut today, which is an infernal bore. Have you any idea of what to order for dinner?" "Cold green soup, grilled swordfish, roast sucking pig, pineapple, and the little round March pancakes, whose name escapes me, with our coffee. Stephen, you'll deal with the quarantine officer, will you not? They've prepared a little douceur in this purse, which I must remember to transfer to the fine clothes Killick is laying out for me. And that reminds me, I must look out for a servant to replace Pardeen at last. Killick will wither quite away if he has to go on looking after us both. I think any newcomer would wither away even quicker under the effect of his ill will. He's grown so used to it since poor Pardeen was sent away that he looks upon you as his own property, and he'd resent anyone else. The only thing he'd bear would be some lumpkin to stand behind you at dinner. With the best will in the world, he cannot stand behind both of us at the same time, and it drives him distracted. But why are you putting out fine clothes? It's only a tavern dinner at Jones. because I must call at the palace and ask for an audience with the Patriarch. On the way back, I shall look in at my banker's correspondent. The dinner at Chowne's had passed off very well, for although the port was in the Portuguese taste, somewhat thin, sharp, and even astringent, the coffee was the best in the world. Dr. Maturin's reception by the Patriarch himself had been kind and gracious beyond expectation, and now he was walking towards what English sailors called Roly-Poly Square, where his banker's Lisbon correspondents had their place of business. He was conscious of a sense of positive well-being. The sun shone upon the broad river and its countless masts, and he was happy for Sam. But he had a feeling that he was being observed. Those criminals, intelligence agents and foxes who survive to have offspring, develop an eye in the back of their heads, he reflected. And when he'd finished dealing with his letter of credit and some other matters, he wasn't surprised at being accosted on the doorstep by a decent-looking man in a brown coat who took off his hat and said, "Dr. Maturin, I presume." Stephen also took off his hat, saying, "Maturin is indeed my name, sir." But he showed no inclination to stop, and the other, hurrying along beside him, went on in a low, urgent tone, "Pray forgive me, sir, for this want of ceremony, but I come from Sir Joseph Blaine. He's just arrived at the Quinta de Monserrate near Sintra, and he begs you will come to see him. I have a carriage close at hand." "My compliments to Sir Joseph, if you please," said Stephen. "I regret I'm not at leisure to wait upon him, but trust I may have the pleasure of a meeting at either the Royal or the Entomological Society when next I am in London. Good day to you, sir." He said this in so decided a tone, and with so very cold a look in his pale eyes, that the messenger didn't persist, but stood there looking wretched. "Damned villain," said Stephen as he crossed the square and began to walk down the Rua d'Ouro. "To come without even a pretence of credentials, supposing that I should hurry off into the hills and beg Taillandier to cut my throat." Taillandier being the principal French agent in Lisbon, and usually much more professional in his methods. "Hola, Stephen," called Jack from the other side of the street. "Well met, shipmate. Come and help me choose some taffeta for Sophie. I want some so fine it'll go through a ring. I'm sure you understand taffeta, Stephen." "I doubt there's a man in the whole of Ballina Slough that understands it better," said Stephen. "And if there is blue taffeta to be had, I shall buy some for Diana too." They walked back to the quay carrying their parcels, and since Jack, not knowing how long they'd be, hadn't taken his own gig ashore, they were about to hail a boat when a party of the Surprise's Liberty men, gathering about the launch, true to their hour, caught sight of them the whole breadth of the square away and roared out, "Never waste your money on a skiff, sir. Come along a wee." Jack went along a they, in the democratical corsair fashion, quite happily, though he was just as glad that there were no serving officers in their formal barges to watch him. Though, in fact, apart from their first free, uninhibited invitation, the Shelmerstonians were as prim and mute as any long-serving man-of-war's men throughout the crossing. It was clear that Jack was right in saying that Killick regarded Stephen as his own property. He at once took him down to the coach and made him take off his fine English broadcloth coat, crying out in a shrill, nagging tone, "Look at these here great slobs of grease, so deep you could plough a furrow in them. And your best satin breeches, oh, Lord, didn't I say you was to call for two napkins, and never mind if they stared. Now it'll be scrub, scrub, brush, brush for poor bloody Killick all through the night watches. Then even then he'll never be the same." "Here is a box of Portugal marchpan for you, Killick," said Stephen. "Well, I'll take it kindly that you remembered, sir," said Killick.
who was passionately fond of marchpane. "Thank you, sir. Now, when you've put on these here old togs, they're quite clean and dry. There's Mr. Martin as would like to have a word with you." For once, the word, which was a serious private one, didn't have to be uttered at the masthead or in the remotest corner of the hold. For Stephen and Martin were both fluent in Latin, and in spite of Martin's barbarous English pronunciation, they understood one another very well. Martin said, "Standish has asked me to approach you, who know Captain Aubrey best, to learn whether you think he'd be likely to entertain a request to resign the pursership. He says you told him there was no cure for seasickness." "So I did, too. And although he's very fond of the sea, he's extremely unwilling to face a repetition of what he's already suffered if the captain will release him from his obligations." "I don't wonder at it. In his case, the prostration was as severe as anything I've ever seen. But I do wonder at the suddenness of his decision. He followed our explanation of the unmooring with the liveliest interest. Yet he was perfectly aware of what he'd undergone and of what in all likelihood he was to undergo again. Yes, it struck me too. But he was always a strange, versatile creature. I believe he suddenly threw up a living in the Anglican Church to the astonishment of his friends. That wasn't quite the same, however. To have the living, he was required to subscribe to the 39 Articles. And the 31st describes masses, forgive me, as blasphemous fables and dangerous deceits. When he came to that, he said he couldn't put his name to it, picked up his hat, bowed to the company and walked off. He was much attached to a Catholic young woman at the time, but what influence that had upon his action, I don't know. We never discussed it. We weren't at all intimate. Stephen made no comment. After a moment, he said, "If Captain Aubrey releases him, what will he do?" "Unless I mistake, he has no money at all." "He means to wander about as Goldsmith did, disputing at universities and the like, and playing his fiddle." "Well, may God be with him. I don't think there'll be any objection to his leaving the ship, splendidly though he plays the violin." They looked at one another, and Martin said, "Poor man. I'm afraid he's made himself much disliked aboard. He wasn't at all like this at Oxford. I believe it was loneliness after the university and all that wretched schoolmastering. On some it acts like a python, making them unfit for the society of grown men. That was what he felt. He was afraid he was no longer good company. He bought a jest book. 'It's my ambition to set the table in a roar,' he said. But upon my honour, I think the seasickness is the true causa causans. Though it is possible that some sharp reflection in the gunroom may have precipitated his decision. In any event, it's honourable in him to feel so bound to Captain Aubrey that he will not leave without permission." "Oh, yes, he's always been perfectly honourable." There was a long pause, and Martin said, "Do you know when the post office will open in the morning? We spent so long in the Irish Sea that the packet is sure to have come before us, perhaps two packets. I long to hear from home." "It opens at 8 o'clock. I shall be there as the bell strikes. So shall I." So they were. And little good did it do them. There was nothing whatsoever for Martin, and only two letters for Dr. Maturin. Jack had a couple from Hampshire, and according to their usual habit, they read them at breakfast, exchanging pieces of family news. Stephen had scarcely broken the seal of his first before he cried, with a passion rare in him, "Upon my word, Jack, that woman is as headstrong as an allegory on the banks of the Nile." Jack wasn't always quick, but this time he instantly grasped that Stephen was talking about his wife, and he said, "Has she taken Barham down?" "She's not only taken it, she's bought it." And in an undertone, "The animal." Sophie always said she was very much set upon the place. Stephen read on and then said, "But she means to live with Sophie until we come home, however. She's only sending Hitchcock and a few horses."
So much the better. Stephen, did she tell you the kitchen boiler at Ashgrove blew up on Tuesday?
She's doing so at this minute. The words are before me.
Brother, there is much to be said for living in a monastery. The next letter did nothing to reconcile him with his lot. It was written in that curiously ungracious business style which his bankers had brought to a state of high perfection. The person who signed it asserted that he was, with great respect, Stephen's humble, obedient servant, but he either ignored questions or gave irrelevant answers, and where quite pressing matters were concerned, he had a way of saying, "These instructions will be carried out in due course." The nearest he could bring himself to an apology for the loss of a paper or certificate was, "It is regretted that if the document in question ever reached our hands, it has temporarily been mislaid. Any inconvenience that may possibly have been caused is deplored." The general tone was contentious. The advice on financial matters was so hedged with reservations as to be valueless. The language was both inflated and incorrect. "Oh, for a fugger! Oh, for a literate fugger!" he said. "Two letters for the doctor, sir, if you please," said Killick, coming in with a sneer on his naturally rather disapproving face. "This here delivered upside down at the starboard gangway by a parcel of lobsters. T'other by a genteel Lisbon craft with a violet awning and handed up decent." Killick had studied the seals with some care. The first, he recognised, the English royal arms impressed in black wax. The second, a violet affair, he couldn't make out at all. But they were both important seals, and naturally he was concerned to find out what the letters contained. Lingering at a suitable distance, he heard Stephen cry, "Give you joy, Jack! Sam is made! He's to be ordained by his own bishop on the 23rd. For Jack, the word "made" was ringed with halos. In the service it had two meanings. The first, a very great happiness, being commissioned. The second, supreme happiness, being appointed post-captain. Yet the world in which he'd been brought up, and which still clung about him most tenaciously, looked upon papists with disfavour. Their loyalty was uncertain, their practices foreign, and Gunpowder Plot and the Jesuits had given them a bad name. And although he could without much difficulty accept Sam as some kind of an acting monk or monk's assistant, Sam as a full-blown popish priest was quite different. But he was extremely fond of Sam, and if the promotion gave Sam joy... "Well, I'm damned!" he exclaimed, all these emotions finding expression in the words. "What is it, Mr. West?"
"I beg pardon, sir," said West, "but the port captain is coming alongside."
Jack being gone, Stephen opened his second letter. It was from the embassy, and it asked him to call at his very earliest convenience.
"Here's your second best coat, sir," said Killick. "I've made a tolerable good job of t'other, but it's not dry yet, and this'll serve in a dark old church. The launch is going over the side this minute."
So it was, too, to judge by the rhythmic cries and the time-honoured oaths and crashes. And when Stephen, neat and brushed with a fresh curled wig and a clean handkerchief, came on deck, the Irish, Polish and North Country English Catholic members of the ship's company who were going to Padeen's Mass had already taken their places. They were in shore-going rig, white-brimmed white sennit hats, watchet-blue trousers with brass buttons, black silk neckerchiefs, white duck trousers, and very small shoes, but with no ribbons in the seams or coloured streamers, a sober finery. Maturin bowed to the port captain, took his leave of Aubrey, and went down the side, scarcely thinking of steps or entering ropes, his mind being so far away. They pulled across to the shore, and leaving the launch with two boatkeepers, they moved off in no sort of formation, gazing at the strangely dressed Portuguese until they came to the Benedictine church. Here, once they'd passed the holy water, they might all have been at home, hearing the same words, the same plain chant, seeing the same formal hieratic motions, and smelling the same incense they'd always known. The mass over, they lit candles for Padine and walked out of the cool, gently lit, timeless, familiar world into the brilliant sunshine of Lisbon, a very recent city, and to many of them quite foreign.
"Good day to you now, shipmates," said Stephen. "You'll never forget the way to the boat, I'm sure. It's right down the hill."
He walked up it towards the embassy, his mind turning back more and more rapidly to worldly things. The porter looked a little doubtfully at his second-best coat, somewhat rusty and threadbare in the full light of the sun, but he sent in his card and the first secretary came hurrying. "I'm so sorry that His Excellency's not in the way this morning," he said, taking Dr. Maturin into his office. "Pray take a seat. But I am to say that the invitation to Monserrate may be accepted with perfect confidence, and that an escort will be provided if it's desired. A coach, too, of course. I should be most grateful for a carriage of some kind. Yet perhaps a well-paced horse would be quicker and less conspicuous if one can be spared." "Certainly. And may I beg you to have a message carried down to the ship?" "Alas, my dear Maturin," cried Sir Joseph from the steps of the Quinta, "I'm afraid you've had a terribly hot ride." Stephen dismounted. The horse was led away, and Sir Joseph went on, "Can you ever forgive me? I was so confused, so weary, so muddle-headed by the time I arrived, that I sent Carrick off empty-handed. My letter to you is still in my pocket. I'll show it to you. Come, walk in out of the sun and drink some lemonade or East India ale or barley water or anything you can think of. Tea, perhaps? If it is agreeable to you, I had as soon sit on the grass in the shade by a brook. I'm not at all thirsty." "What a beautiful idea." And as they walked along, "Maturin, why do you carry your hat in that curious way? If I were to walk bareheaded in the sun, or even with a small bobwig, I should be struck down dead." "There is an insect in it that I shall show you when we sit down. Here's a perfect place. Green leaves overhead, sweet-smelling grass, a murmuring brook." He opened his folded hat, took out a pocket handkerchief and spread it on the ground. The creature, quite unharmed, stood there gently swaying on its long legs. It was a very large insect indeed, greenish, with immense antennae and a disproportionately small, meek, and indeed rather stupid face. "Bless me," said Blaine, "it's not a mantis, and yet it is Saga Pedo." Of course, I've seen him figured, but never preserved, nor even dried, far less alive and swaying at me. What a glorious animal! But look at those wicked serrated limbs, two pairs of them. Where did you find him?" "On the side of the road, just outside Sintram. She, if I may be pedantic. In these parts, the females alone are seen. They reproduce parthenogenetically, which must surely ease some of the tensions of family life." "Yes, I remember from Olivier's paper. But surely you don't mean to let her go? So rare." The saga was walking confidently off the handkerchief and into the grass. "I do, though. Who is without superstition? It seems to me that letting her go may have a favourable influence upon our meeting. For I assume that it's no trifling matter that has brought you to Portugal." Blaine followed the saga until it vanished among the grass stems. Then, turning resolutely away, he said, "No, by God. A little while ago the heavens fell on our heads, opened and fell on our heads. The Spanish ambassador called at the Foreign Office and asked whether there was any truth in the report that the surprise had been fitted out and sent to encourage rebels or potential rebels, independentists in the Spanish South American possessions. Oh, dear me, no, he was told. The surprise was merely a privateer, one of many going to cruise upon United States whalers and China-bound ships and any Frenchman she happened to meet. This absurd report must have arisen from a confusion with a perfectly genuine French expedition designed for that very purpose, an expedition that had been frustrated by our capture of the Diane, which was to carry the agents, an expedition that could be substantiated, if any substantiation against such very grave and indeed monstrous charges were required, by the production of documents seized aboard the French frigate. The Spaniard may not have been wholly convinced, though he was certainly shaken. He said he should be very glad to see any evidence, particularly that inculpating those who had been in correspondence with the French, our common enemies. He expressed some surprise that the substance of these documents hadn't been communicated to him before, but that was easily accounted for by the extreme slowness of British official procedures. Blaine took off his shoes and stockings, shifted a little forward on the grass, and dangled his feet in the stream. "Oh, what a relief," he said. "Machelin, I have had a most hellish journey from Corunna, sleeping in the coach, jolting over vile roads, 8 and even 10 mules, scarcely enough sometimes, the heat, the dust, the dreadful inns, wheels coming off, axles breaking, brigands, large, desperate, isolated bodies of French and their unpaid mercenaries, our own army pushing us off the road onto byways, blind alleys, mountain tracks, a furious French advance that came very near to cutting us off, goat's milk in the coffee, goat's milk in the tea, but above all, the perpetual hurry, perpetual weariness and heat. The flies! Forgive me again for being so stupid about Carrick. Forgive me if my account of the situation is out of sequence, patchy, disordered. A clear mind is wanted for such complexity, not one that has just been trundled over rocks and deserts that will be a disgrace to Ethiopia. No doubt there were good reasons why you didn't take the packet or one of the Admiralty yachts. 2 excellent reasons. The first, that although the packet did in fact reach Lisbon long before me, there was no guaranteeing that it wouldn't be wind-bound for a month, whereas, once I was on Spanish soil, I could be sure that perseverance would get me to Portugal within certain limits of time if I survived. The second, that purgatorial though the journey was, I preferred it to a voyage by sea. I'm most horribly seasick, and I should certainly have lost essential elements in my grasp of the situation. He sat stirring his feet in the water and rehearsing the order of events in his mind, and presently he said, "You will already have perceived that this most damaging information can have reached the Spaniards only through one of the very few men who knew about your mission. Almost certainly, the man who protected Ray and Ledward and allowed them to get out of the country. Warren and I suspected that the report would be sent, and that is why I particularly insisted upon your calling at Lisbon."
I had imagined that to be your motive.
In the same way I had understood from the beginning that our journey to South America was also intended to counteract Bonapartist influence there,
and your earliest reference to the Diane made it even more certain.
From my own personal point of view, this conflict with the French was of the first importance. Of course it was, and will be again in the same region, I hope. But for the moment, we must utterly demolish the report and discredit the source of information. The surprise must carry on with her voyage, ostentatiously privateering and avoiding all contact with the supporters of independence. There was a pause, and Stephen observed that Blaine was looking at him with a quizzical eye, his head cocked on one side. But he made no observation, and after the cool breeze had wafted through the leaves for a while, Blaine went on, "But although you and Aubrey will not be fully employed in that hemisphere, I trust that if you agree to my plan, you will be even more so in another. The French have learnt, probably through this same source, Ledwood's protector, that except on paper, we're extremely weak in Java and the East Indies in general. They have therefore sent a mission to the Sultan of Pulo Prabang, one of the piratical Malay states in the South China Sea, urging him to become their ally and to build and equip vessels large enough to capture our East Indiamen on their way to and from Canton, thus cutting the company's throat. The Sultan's dominions lie almost directly across the Indiaman's route. He has a splendid harbour, forests of teak and everything that's desirable, and a hardy population of seafaring Malays who have hitherto confined themselves to native craft and to piracy on a modest scale. Chinese junks, the occasional Arab dhow. The French have sent shipwrights, tools, materials, guns, and treasure. Their official envoy is Jean Duplessis, something of a nonentity. The man who will really conduct the affair is Ledwood. He spent much of his youth in Penang, and I'm told that he speaks Malay like a native. At all events, I know he held an important post there under the company, and that he is an unusually able negotiator. The French have sent Ray, too, more with the idea of getting rid of him than for any use he's likely to be. Once he'd ceased to be of value to them in Paris, he was treated with great neglect and contempt, whereas Ledwood always retained a certain position. Blaine stopped to collect his ideas again, but shaking his head, he went on, "Do you mind if we go back into the house? If I were given a good pot of tea, a good pot of brown London tea, I believe it might clear my wits." "Sure, I only wish to be outside to release my saga," said Stephen, "and if I might be indulged in a glass of white wine, I should happily watch you drink your tea. In a place designed by Beckford, you should be able to rely on an honest brew." "Did you ever read Vathek?" "I tried on the recommendation of men whose taste I respected." Sir Joseph drank his tea and Stephen his wine in an immensely long, cool gallery on the north side of the house, with a flight of windows looking out onto gardens, lawns with three different streams flowing through the grass, copses, and on the rising ground beyond a noble wood, while the gallery's opposite wall held a great number of large pictures, mostly of the last age and mostly allegorical. In this sweep of space, the two men sitting in English armchairs with a little table between them looked minute. They could speak without the least fear of being overheard. "Of course," said Blaine, "we plan a counter-mission, and we have a capital man to take charge of it. His name is Fox, Edward Fox. He was my guest once at the dinner of the Royal Society Club, and afterwards you heard him read a paper on the spread of Buddhism eastward and its subsequent relations with Brahmanism and the Muslims." "Certainly. A man of unusual parts." "Yes, of most unusual parts. And yet he has never been appreciated at his full value. Always acting temporary appointments, always moved on to some other administration. Perhaps there's some fault of manner, a certain unorthodoxy, a certain bitterness from want of recognition. But there are undoubtedly remarkable abilities, and he might have been made for this particular undertaking. He is, by the way, a friend of Raffles, the governor of Java, another interesting man." "So I'm told. I've not met the gentleman, but I've seen some of his letters to banks. They think of founding a zoological society. Fox, too, was in Penang at one time, and it is from him that I have my information about Ledwood in that respect." A long silence followed. The room was so still that a turtle dove could be heard a great way off. "But naturally," continued Blaine, draining his pot, "we have to get our envoy there before the French have converted their man and signed their treaty. It can certainly be done, given equal diligence, because although they have a start, Fox and all other authorities assure me that with potentates of the Sultan's kind, these things are never concluded without discussions lasting a month or two. And because, since we control the Sunda Strait, the French have to go very, very much farther round. It can be done. I mean, they can be frustrated, undermined, done in the eye. And I will tell you how I think we should set about it. I've said how essentially important it is that this report about South America should be scorched, have I not? You emphasized it as strongly as possible. Very well, then. Now, according to my plan, the Surprise will carry on with her avowable activities under her second-in-command and her present ship's company. The authorities' confidential arrangement for her hire will continue in force, and you and Aublin will take the envoy to Pulau Prabang in the Dian, which has been brought into the service. We'd meant to wait until there was a victory that could be announced together with the news of Aubrey's reinstatement, a question of saving official face, but now it's agreed that the country's interests will be better served by openly, publicly, almost ostentatiously reinstating him and giving him this command. What more convincing proof that you are neither of you going to Peru? Stephen nodded. Blaine went on, but that is not all. Let us suppose that the Surprise makes her way into the Pacific in Captain Pulling's able hands. His name has come back to me. And there, having done what she ostensibly set out to do, she sails to some given rendezvous. And then let us suppose that the Dian, having dealt with the situation in Pulau Prabang, joins the Surprise at this rendezvous so that you can return by South America, thus being enabled to make at least some of the discreet contacts that we had planned. What do you say to that, Maturin? Stephen looked at him for some moments with an expressionless face. Then he said, "It is a grandiose scheme. I am in favour of it. But I cannot answer for Aubrey." "No, of course you can't. Yet an answer must we have within 2 days, no more. Clearly I don't know Aubrey as well as you, not by 1,000 miles. But I have little doubt of what he'll say.